Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Tuesday, November 2nd, 2021. I'm your reader, Paula Carezzi. Tuesday's weather in the Dubuque area will be mostly sunny, with a high of 44 and a low of 24. On the front page of Tuesday's Telegraph Herald is an article by Ali Hinga, titled, Ex-Holy Family School Official Pleads Guilty. Todd Wessels is convicted in federal court of stealing at least $250,000 from the system. A former administrator at Holy Family Catholic Schools in Dubuque has pleaded guilty to wire fraud after prosecutors said he stole at least $250,000 from the system. Todd C. Wessels, aged 49, of Dubuque, pleaded guilty to one count of wire fraud Monday in federal court in Cedar Rapids, according to a press release from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Iowa. A sentencing hearing has not yet been set, and Wessels remains free on bond. He faces up to 20 years in prison, a $250,000 fine, and 3 years of supervised release. There is no parole in the federal system. Attempts to reach Wessels and his attorney Monday afternoon were unsuccessful. Wessels resigned last year as principal of Holy Ghost Elementary School and as Holy Family's curriculum technology director. The count of wire fraud to which Wessels pleaded guilty is connected with his use of PayPal to buy a handmade string instrument for $449 in 2019. However, the release and court documents state that Wessels stole at least $250,000 from Holy Family, starting, quote, no later than June 11th, end quote, through at least February 2020. Those documents detail the extent of the investigation into Wessels' use of system funds. Documents state that Wessels purchased prepaid debit cards using the school system's store credit cards under the pretense that he needed money for computer apps or office supplies. He transferred the money on the prepaid cards to a PayPal account he had opened in Holy Family's name, and also provided receipts for the purchase of the cards on the pretense that they were used for legitimate school purchases. Wessels also sold Holy Family computer equipment online, received funds from those sales via PayPal, and used the money for, quote, his own personal use, end quote, documents state. Documents state that Holy Family officials gave Wessels, quote, substantial discretion when purchasing technology-related items, end quote. Quote, Wessels represented to the school district that he had substantial experience with technology-related items, and the school district trusted the defendant as its so-called resident expert on technology matters, documents state. Quote, defendant would often test computers and make demonstrations for the school district's teachers, giving the appearance that he and the school district were, quote, on the cutting edge of technology, end quote. Quote, as a consequence, the school district's administration permitted the defendant to make purchases on behalf of the school district with little or no oversight, end quote. Holy Family officials started looking further into Wessels' spending in 2019 and continued to do so into early 2020. In response, Wessels lied to administrators and submitted false invoices and receipts, documents state. Chief Administrator Philip Borman ultimately discovered false invoices by reaching out to vendors, quote, and determining the purchases did not exist, end quote, documents state. Administrators also accessed the PayPal account showing that Wessels had provided fraudulent information and that the account was receiving funds from the sale of Holy Family computer equipment. Quote, the administrators also discovered large travel, theater, and food expenses, as well as defendant's own personal electric bill for his residence and other purchases for the benefit of defendant and his family, documents state. Those purchases included a swimming pool, expensive light bulbs, beef brisket, virtual reality headsets, robots, Apple TVs, quote, and more than a dozen Beats earbuds and earphones, end quote. Documents note that due, quote, to a lack of written inventory, the full extent of defendant's theft is not known, end quote. In response to a request for comment, Holy Family officials forwarded to the Telegraph Herald a copy of the message sent to families and staff about Wessels' plea. In it, Borman wrote that officials will seek full restitution for the funds Wessels spent and that funds they recover, quote, will be reinvested in the system through endowments for programming and financial assistance for the long-term benefit of our students and the strength of our schools, end quote. Borman wrote that system leaders can only accomplish their mission by maintaining the trust and confidence of the people they serve. Quote, "In that spirit, I assure you, Holy Family holds its employees to the highest ethical standards of expectation and has in place sound policies and procedures to reasonably prevent a situation like this from reoccurring in the future," Borman wrote. In Dubuque area news, polls open 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. for today's election. Polls are open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. for the election today in Dubuque County. All absentee ballots must be received by 8 p.m. to be considered on time to be counted. In Dubuque, City Council members Brad Kavanaugh and David Resnick are running for mayor. Incumbent Rick Jones and challenger Michaela Freiberger are competing for an at-large City Council seat. Newcomer Ricky Carner II and incumbent Danny Sprank are seeking the council's Ward 3 seat. Incumbent Susan Farber is running unopposed to retain her Ward 1 seat. Seven candidates seek an at-large position on the Dubuque Community School District Board of Directors. Current members Nancy Bradley and Anderson Sanchi, as well as potential newcomers Jake Eilders, Katie Jones, Cynthia Mueller, Whitney Sanger, and Derricka Williams-Robinson. Other ballot questions range from a hotel-motel tax in Piasta to Dubuque County's conservation referendum to school taxing issues in several area communities. Benjamin Fisher of the Telegraph Herald writes, "Health providers pitch another $1.1 million in projects." Four more mental health projects were presented to Dubuque County Supervisors Monday for their consideration in allocating millions in one-time state and federal funding. The four projects from area mental health providers totaled $1.14 million and ranged from infrastructure to staffing. These join seven other projects already presented, making the list of proposals total more than $5 million. This is part of the Board of Supervisors' ongoing vetting of projects competing for the $19 million the county was allocated through the American Rescue Plan Act. Supervisors are hearing mental health projects first, though, since they also have a $1 million fund balance through Mental Health Disability Services of the East Central Region, which has to be spent by June 30, 2022, or surrendered back to the state. Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center requested $1 million from the county to support and expand services through its new mobile unit, a specialized RV aimed at bringing physical and mental health access to underserved areas of Dubuque County, especially in low-income and rural areas. Quote, "We could be in Farley in the morning and Epworth in the afternoon. Take advantage of the whole day," said Michelle Arensdorf, Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center Community Education and Wellness Coordinator and a registered nurse who will head the program. The proposal was to bolster staffing for the mobile unit, stock it with equipment and medication, and maintain the specialty vehicle. Supervisor Ann McDonough said she had heard positive feedback from mayors of the county's smaller cities. Quote, "When you come to each of these communities, they would like to welcome you and be first on the bus," she said. "They are really excited that there's a brain health screening as part of this because they know," end quote. Supervisor Jay Wickham said he was less convinced that the program is a good use of mental health funds, but supported it for other uses, like immediate COVID-19 vaccinations. Hillcrest Family Services requested $100,000 to install an elevator in its A New Day Walk-In Mental Health Center on its campus across from Flora Park. This would grant access for all individuals to the building's now vacant second floor for expanded services. The Northeast Iowa Area Agency on Aging asked for $17,770 to support its mental health services, which have seen increased need since the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. Officials added that they could also easily expend $50,000 through those services if supervisors saw fit. St. Mark's Youth Enrichment similarly requested $25,000 to support the expanded need it has seen in the pandemic. Supervisors will hear from at least three more mental health providers at their next meeting, Monday, November 8th. Then they will discuss and decide which projects to present to the Regional Governing Board for the $1 million fund balance on November 15th. After that, they will continue hearing presentations from other sectors looking for a piece of the county's $19 million ARPA pie before final decisions by year's end. Bennett Goldstein writes, as revenue dwindles, UWP looks for recruitment retention solutions. The university is facing a $5.4 million deficit this year as enrollment declines. Student enrollment declines continues to bedevil University of Wisconsin-Platteville leaders as they work to develop a sustainable funding model. Multiple years of staff cuts, furloughs, voluntary retirements, and hiring restrictions helped shrink the institution's budget, but it faces another deficit this year, totaling $5.4 million. If no changes are made and the university spends the entire budgeted amount, the figure could balloon to $23.5 million by 2026. Quote, with the reduction in tuition revenues, we have had to make some significant cuts, Vice Chancellor Paige Smith recently told employees at a faculty senate meeting. Quote, as we see a declining student enrollment, we also need to balance that with the amount of full-time employees that we have on campus as well, end quote. The challenges largely stem from a shrinking student body and tuition revenue, which comprises nearly a third of UWP's $176.1 million budget. Enrollment declined more than 10% at UWP's Platteville campus, from 7,140 students in fall 2020 to 6,416 this semester. That includes a loss of 286 students who withdrew during the 2020-21 academic year or did not return afterward. Administrators also attribute the loss to a decline in the yield rate, which is the number of student applicants who ultimately enroll at UWP. Consequently, the proportion of the student body at UWP is skewing older, with seniors comprising a growing percentage. We're seeing a lot more students graduate than we bring in, said Victoria Livingston, Executive Director of Enrollment and Student Success. The obstacles UWP faces are common among Midwestern public institutions. The National Student Clearinghouse Research Center reported that undergraduate fall 2021 enrollment decreased by 3.2% relative to the previous year, about the same drop observed between fall 2019 and fall 2020. At less selective public universities like UWP, freshman class sizes decreased 5.4%. The institution has already adjusted its communications and financial aid strategies in hopes of expanding new freshman classes. Livingston said the establishment of personal connections between students and staff have proven more effective than organizing campus visits, recruiting in high schools, and sending mass emails. UWP also is reaching out to students who withdrew to ascertain their circumstances and encourage them to return. The institution intends to marshal its resources to distribute an expected $40 million in federal, state, institutional, and university foundation aid within the next year. UWP recently expanded its so-called Pioneer Pledge program, which covers the costs of tuition and segregated fees for low-income students from Wisconsin, Iowa, Illinois, and Minnesota. Smith anticipates that the institution's tendency to underspend will enable the university to absorb the projected deficit this year. Meanwhile, budget planners have begun meeting with departments to help them plan for the 2023 fiscal year. In news from across the tri-states, in Elizabeth, Illinois, University Extension to host two programs. The University of Illinois Extension will host two programs in Elizabeth next week. Energy and Environmental Stewardship Educator Jay Solomon will lead Invasive and Problematic Plants in the Landscape from 1 to 2:30 p.m. Thursday, November 11th at the Elizabeth Community Building, US 20 West. Solomon will discuss how to identify the difference between invasive plants, potentially harmful non-native species, and nuisance plants, which might be native but can cause problems. Management methods will be discussed. There is no fee, but pre-registration is requested. The following day, Solomon will host a second program from 2 to 3:30 p.m. at the Elizabeth Community Building. In this program, titled Radon, Still an Indoor Issue, attendees will learn what radon is and how it enters a home, the danger radon poses, and how a home can be tested. Each household will receive a free radon test kit. The cost to attend the event is $10 per household. Pre-registration is requested for both by calling the University of Illinois Extension at 815-858-2273. In news from Wisconsin, bill would stiffen highway traffic penalties. A Southwest Wisconsin lawmaker is co-sponsoring legislation that would enhance penalties for traffic violations committed within highway construction and maintenance areas. State Senator Howard Markline, a Republican from Spring Green, has signed on to a bill that would double fines and forfeitures for failing to follow signs and signals, exceeding speed limits, and driving recklessly on a highway adjacent to roadside cleanup and maintenance workers, including litter collectors. Currently, fines enhancements apply only within the proximity of highway construction work. The bill has been referred to a Senate committee. Dairy Day's annual meeting set for Wednesday in Platteville. An annual meeting devoted to a popular Platteville event will take place this week. The Platteville Dairy Day's annual meeting will be held 7 p.m. Wednesday, November 3rd at the Platteville Regional Chamber Office, 275 West Business 151. A review of the 2021 Dairy Days event will be followed by an election of officers. The board has three open three-year positions. In news from Iowa, cards and letters sought for celebration of longtime mayor's retirement in Manchester. Organizers seek cards and letters from well-wishers amid preparations to celebrate the retirement of longtime Manchester mayor Milt Kramer. Kramer is retiring on Friday, December 31st. He was first elected to the Manchester City Council in 1970 and assumed the mayoral post in 1974. He was subsequently elected for 14 consecutive terms. Kramer taught high school social studies and coached in the West Delaware school system from 1963 to 1997. Kramer's retirement celebration is planned from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, December 2nd in the City Council chambers. Cards or letters to Kramer can be sent to Manchester Area Chamber of Commerce, care of Kramer Celebration, 200 East Main Street, Manchester, Iowa, 52057. Emails can be sent to ltthomas@manchester-ia.org. In Jackson County, Heritage Day planned this weekend. The Jackson County Historical Society will host its annual Heritage Day celebration this weekend. The event will begin at 2:30 p.m. Sunday, November 7th, in Jansen Hall at the Jackson County Fairgrounds, 1212 East Quarry Street. The afternoon will feature inductions into the 2021 Jackson County Historical Society Hall of Fame, as well as a presentation from the Friends of the Library and a dinner catered by Geronimo's Bar and Grill in Springbrook. Admission is $13 in advance or $15 at the door. Tickets can be purchased at the Clinton Engines Museum on Maple Street or at the County Museum located inside the Pearson Memorial Center on the Jackson County Fairgrounds. For more information, call the Jackson County Historical Society at 563-652-5020. In Cascade, the Cascade Public Library will present an evening of the stories and poems of Edgar Allan Poe this week. Morbid Curiosities, featuring actor and storyteller Darren Crowe, will take place at 6:30 p.m. Wednesday, November 3rd at Two Gingers Eatery, 231 First Avenue West. In news from Dubuque, church to host free food distribution event. A Dubuque church will hold another free food distribution event this weekend. Holy Trinity Lutheran Church will be hosting the event from 9 to 11 a.m. or while supplies last on Saturday, November 6th at the church, at 1755 Delhi Street, according to an online release. The distribution is in partnership with St. Stephen's Food Bank. Organizers ask that people stay in vehicles while food is brought to them. The church also has a miniature food pantry on a post outside of the church and a food cabinet inside the church entryway. Both are open all day, every day. Let's turn now to the insight page of Tuesday's Telegraph Herald. That's the opinion page, sorry. In today's letter from the editor, Amy Gilligan writes, "Your local guide to local elections. Happy Election Day. Here's hoping voting is on your agenda today if you haven't already cast your ballot. If you need any last-minute review of the candidates, you can find them on telegraphherald.com. Be sure to check the website tonight for the most up-to-date results throughout the area. We'll be up late tonight to deliver a full slate of results in tomorrow's Telegraph Herald." Missing target ad. There's a change coming to our package of advertising supplements inserted into the paper that I need to tell you about. We learned recently that Target will be pulling its advertising from Telegraph Herald and all newspapers across the country beginning this week and for the rest of 2021. We didn't get much of an explanation as to why Target corporate officials reached this decision, but apparently they believe our readers are not relying on the Target ad to make them aware of the store's sales and specials. I tend to disagree. I know for many people, Sunday means a late breakfast while perusing the Target ad to determine what they, quote, need, end quote, before making a weekly Target run. When I had four young kids, I was even more dependent on scoping out the deals and matching them up with coupons in the Telegraph Herald. I'm pretty disappointed to see the Target ad go away, and I'm hopeful it's just temporary. I'm sure some readers will feel the same. Calling our TH customer service representatives to complain won't move the needle in this case. We'd like the ad back too, but Target did provide a toll-free number for reader questions and comments. My suggestion would be letting Target know you value having the ad inserted in your hometown newspaper. To weigh in, call 800-440-0680. Nominate a local leader for First Citizen Award. On January 1st, we will confer on a local person or people the Telegraph Herald First Citizen Award for the 52nd time. For more than half a century, the Telegraph Herald has singled out some of the greatest leaders in local history for this time-honored award. It has become the premier such honor in our community and something of a lifetime achievement award for folks who have consistently set the bar high and exceeded expectations. Our First Citizen Award recipients have been groups and individuals from all corners of our community, humble servants in religious life, leaders of business and industry, extraordinary volunteers, incredible philanthropists. With a variety of achievements to their name, these individuals continue to inspire others and make our community better. Each found a way to work above and beyond their regular occupations to help others and make our community a better place to live, work, and play. Last year's award was conferred on Judy Wolf in a small live-streamed event because of COVID-19. While live-streaming has long been part of our First Citizen reception, we hope to get back to a normal gathering in January. Details to come on that event. As of now, nominations for First Citizen can be submitted at the website telegraphherald.com/firstcitizen or mailed or dropped off to me at the Telegraph Herald through Wednesday, December 1st. I'm excited to see the nominations for recognition of Dubuque's great leaders. Again, that's the Letter from the Editor column by Amy Gilligan on Tuesday's opinion page. In a letter to the editor, Raymond Roberts of Nottingham Court in Dubuque writes, "Funeral industry story captures kindness of Siegert. I read with interest your article in the October 24th issue on funeral practices. I have dealt with Tom Siegert more times than I care to remember, from 1990 to June of this year. He is truly one of the nicest, kindest people I know. All of the quotes attributed to him and his services are exactly true. The quote that I found most telling from Tom was, quote, 'You become part of the family for 3 or 4 days,' end quote. During those most difficult days, Tom becomes the father, brother, son, or even just best friend that you would like to have always had. It almost, but not quite, makes you wish you had more opportunities to see him." Signed, Raymond Roberts of Nottingham Court in Dubuque. Tuesday's opinion page also includes an Other View column written by Jonah Goldberg, editor-in-chief of the Dispatch, titled, "Nuclear Power Fights Climate Change." As world leaders convene in Glasgow to make plans and promises to tackle climate change, Joe Biden had hoped to have a stack of climate-related legislative accomplishments to brag about, but they're being held up in the fight over the cost of the Build Back Better reconciliation bill. The stakes, we're constantly told, couldn't be higher. If Democratic Senator Joe Manchin and the Republicans succeed in stripping just the proposed clean energy performance program alone, it will, quote, destroy the world, end quote, according to Gizmodo. Joe Biden doesn't go that far. But recently, at a CNN town hall, he repeated his oft-cited claim that climate change poses an, quote, existential threat to humanity, end quote. Such rhetoric isn't merely wrong. Humanity can survive climate change. It's also counterproductive. the fight against climate change will be long and messy, and implying otherwise will make it longer and messier. For 30 years, activists and politicians have said before these periodic climate confabs that this is our so-called last chance to act or save the planet. Normally, if you miss your last chance to do something, catch a flight, see a movie, etc., you stop trying. If you think climate change should be the moral equivalent of war, then you should manage expectations like a wartime leader does. You don't say, quote, "We'll lose the war if we lose this one battle," end quote, unless it's true. You also don't refuse to use your most effective weapons, at least not in a fight for the survival of humanity, without good reason. And in this case, the best weapon in our arsenal is nuclear power. As former NASA climatologist James Hansen and his colleagues have argued, there's, quote, "no credible path to climate stabilization that does not include a substantial role for nuclear power," end quote. But to quote Greta Thunberg, the Joan of Arc of climate activism, the arguments against nuclear power boil down to it being, quote, "extremely dangerous, expensive," end quote, and, quote, "time-consuming," end quote. Let's start with dangerous. For reasons of human psychology, deep-seated fear of nuclear power is socially acceptable among those who claim to, quote, "follow the science," end quote. But just as the COVID-19 vaccines have saved the lives of hundreds of thousands of people, a few people, literally a few, have had bad reactions to the vaccine that may have contributed to their deaths. Whatever that number is, 3, 4, that's more Americans than have died from nuclear power. The Three Mile Island nuclear accident, the worst in American history, caused no deaths or detectable incidents of cancer. The 2011 earthquake and tsunami that destroyed the Fukushima nuclear power plant was very deadly, killing up to 18,000 people. But the number of radiation-related deaths or illnesses connected to the power plant meltdown have been in the low double digits. The first confirmed radiation-related death occurred in 2018. The UN reports that so far, the, quote, "most important health effect," end quote, hasn't been a spike in cancer, but the damage to, quote, "mental and social well-being," end quote, caused by the earthquake and tsunami. Indeed, if you include all factors, including industrial accidents, air pollution, etc., nuclear power is arguably the world's safest form of energy production. Then there's the cost. It's true. Building nuclear power plants, whether with existing or new technology, is expensive. But once the nuclear plants are built, the energy they produce is cheap. That's why Germany, which has been mothballing its nuclear plants in a largely failed decade-long experiment, has the most expensive electricity rates in the world. And Germany's carbon emissions are 10 times greater than those of France, which gets 70% of its electricity from nuclear power. Wherever nuclear plants have been closed, writes Ted Nordhaus, founder of the Breakthrough Institute, quote, "clean electricity has been replaced with dirty power," end quote. There's also something weird about politicians who scoff at cost concerns to fight climate change on their terms and then raise the cost of building nuclear plants as prohibitive when they can provide carbon-free electricity on a massive and reliable scale. Indeed, one reason it takes so long for nuclear plants to get built is that many of these politicians stand in the way of getting them built by pandering to NIMBYism and supporting red tape. They're all in for so-called decarbonizing transportation while opposing technology that will keep electricity affordable. None of this is to say that nuclear power alone is a silver bullet, nor is it to deny that the question of how to deal with nuclear waste isn't a thorny one, especially after President Obama rejected science in favor of politics to shut down the perfectly safe Yucca Mountain Waste Repository. Some old plants do need to be shut down, but they should be replaced with new, safer, and less expensive ones. But if Biden is serious about fighting climate change and wants to show it, he should take nuclear power seriously. Again, this is the opinion of Jonah Goldberg, editor-in-chief of The Dispatch. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Tuesday, November 2nd, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Terrence J. O'Rourke, aged 72, of Dubuque, passed away Tuesday, October 26th, surrounded by his family. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Tuesday, November 9th at St. Patrick's Catholic Church with Monsignor Thomas Toll officiating. A visitation from 3 to 8 p.m. at Egelhoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory on John F. Kennedy Road with a parish scripture service at 7:30 p.m. Full military honors will be accorded by the Epworth American Legion Post, number 650. Luke Wohlers, aged 59, of Dyersville, died on Thursday, October 28th. Visitation will be held from 3 to 8 p.m. Thursday, November 4th, at Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville. Services will take place at 10 a.m. Friday, November 5th, at Journey Church in Dubuque. Rita Feldman, aged 89, of Edgewood, formerly of Hopkinton, passed away Sunday, October 31st, at Edgewood Convalescent Home in Edgewood. Visitation will be held 2 to 8 p.m. Wednesday, November 3rd, at Kramer Funeral Home on 12th Avenue Southwest in Dyersville, where a rosary will be held at 2 p.m. Visitation will continue from 9 to 10 a.m. Thursday at Kramer Funeral Home prior to services. A Mass of Christian Burial will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, November 4th, at St. Luke's Catholic Church in Hopkinton, with burial in Hopkinton Cemetery. Reverend Paul Baldwin will officiate. Lois M. Knuckle, aged 61, of Marion and formerly of Dubuque, passed away on Thursday, October 28th, at her home in Marion. In accordance with her wishes, cremation has taken place. A celebration of Lois's life is being planned for a later date. Lois was born on October 15, 1960, in Wisconsin. She was a graduate of East Dubuque High School and went on to attend Kirkwood Community College. Lois was employed at Evergreen 3 Nursing Home for more than 20 years. Please share a memory of Lois at the website murdochfuneralhome.com. Joyce A. Thilmany, age 91, of Dubuque, died Friday, October 29th. Visitation will be from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Monday, November 8th, at Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory on Asbury Road, where services will follow. Glenn E. Curtis, aged 95, of Cuba City, died Sunday, October 31st. Visitation will be held from 9 to 10:45 a.m. Friday, November 5th, at United Methodist Church in Cuba City, where services will take place at 11 a.m. Casey McNeck Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Cuba City is assisting the family. Richard C. Hoffman, aged 87, of Lancaster, passed away Friday, October 29th, at Lancaster Health Services in Lancaster. He was born November 20th, 1933, in Little Grant Township, the son of George and Helen Ball Hoffman. In 1943, the family moved to a farm west of Lancaster on County A. Richard graduated from St. Clement Grade School and Lancaster High School in 1951. A Mass of Christian Burial will be Saturday, November 6th at 10:30 a.m. at St. Clement Catholic Church in Lancaster, with Father William Verning officiating. Burial with military honors will be in St. Clement Cemetery in Lancaster. Family and friends may call on Friday, November 5th from 4 to 7 p.m. at Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory in Lancaster, where a 3:45 p.m. parish rosary will be prayed. Friends may also call on Saturday from 9:30 a.m. until time of services at the church. In lieu of plants and flowers, a Richard C. Hoffman Memorial Fund has been established. Online condolences may be left at the website martinschwartzfuneralhomes.com. Michael J. Koch, known as Mike, aged 49, of Epworth, passed away at 1:14 a.m. on Tuesday, October 26th, at the Veterans Hospital in Iowa City. To celebrate Mike's life, family and friends may visit from 2 p.m. until 5 p.m. on Thursday, November 4th, at Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street. There will be military honors provided by the Dubuque Marine Corps League at 5 p.m. Mike was born July 26, 1972, in Dubuque, son of Michael and Linda Cass Koch. Mike graduated from Dubuque Senior High School before going on to honorably serve his country with the U.S. Marines for 6 years. The family will thankfully receive your support through phone calls, greeting cards, and memorials in Mike's memory, which may be mailed to Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street, Dubuque, 52001, attention Michael Koch family. Online condolences may be left for the family at the website bearfuneralhome.com. Laura L. Friedel, known as Nana, age 98, of Cuba City, passed away peacefully with her family by her side on Saturday, October 30th, in Shellsburg, Wisconsin. A memorial service will be held at 11:30 a.m. on Thursday, November 4th, at the Houdenshield Funeral Home and Cremation Services in Cuba City, with Pastor Joanne Meyer officiating. A private family burial will be held at a later date. Family and friends may call from 9:30 a.m. until the time of service on Thursday, November 4th at the funeral home. In lieu of plants and flowers, a Laura L. Friedel Memorial Fund has been established. Memorials may be mailed to Houdenshield Funeral Home, care of Laura Friedel Family, Box 825, Cuba City, Wisconsin, 53807. Grace R. Sarazen Clancy, age 94, of Dubuque, passed away peacefully at 2:10 a.m. on one of her favorite holidays, Halloween, Sunday, October 31st, at her home, surrounded by her loving family. To celebrate Grace's life, family and friends may visit from 3 p.m. until 7 p.m. on Wednesday, November 3rd, at Bear Funeral Home on Main Street, where there will be a parish scripture service held at 6:30 p.m. To honor Grace's life, funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. on Thursday, November 4th, at Holy Spirit Parish, Sacred Heart Church, on Windsor Avenue, with Reverend Stephen M. Garner officiating. Burial will be in Dubuque Memorial Gardens. Online condolences may be left for the family at Bear Funeral Home, and the family will thankfully receive your support through phone calls, greeting cards, and memorials in Grace's memory, mailed to Baird Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street in Dubuque. Attention, Grace Clancy family. Doris M. Malone. With profound sadness, we announce the passing of Doris, our loving and devoted mother. Doris Magdalena Malone, aged 85, passed away in Dubuque due to heart complications on October 29th. She was born December 6th, 1935, in Keeler, Wisconsin. Doris was vibrant, caring, kind, and resilient, an inspiration to those around her. Please join us in celebrating her life Saturday, on the 6th of November. A memorial mass will take place at 11 a.m. at Holy Ghost Catholic Church, 2921 Central Avenue in Dubuque. Doors will open at 10 a.m. for a brief visitation. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to St. Mary's Steeple Square at steeplesquare.com. Orlando Giovanni Valente passed away on October 18th, peacefully under the loving care of the staff of the Stonehill community and his loving family. To celebrate Orlando's life, family and friends may visit from 10 a.m. until 12 noon on Saturday, November 6th at Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street. Funeral services will be held at 12 noon on Saturday at Bear Funeral Home with Pastor Marilyn Hendricks officiating. Interment will be in the Mount Calvary Cemetery Columbarium. Orlando was born in the mountains of northern Italy on February 18th, 1939. He was the eldest of seven siblings. To provide a better opportunity in life for his siblings, he began the process of immigration to America. The family arrived in Chicago in 1960, and everyone old enough and able began to work to help the family get established. The family will thankfully receive your support through phone calls, greeting cards, and memorials in Orlando's memory, which may be mailed to Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street in Dubuque. Attention, Orlando Valente family. Online condolences may be left for the family at the website bearfuneralhome.com. Marina J. Klein, aged 92, of Dubuque, formerly of Rickardsville, died peacefully Tuesday, October 26th, at Assisi Village, which has been her home since 1999. Visitation will be from 3 p.m. until 7 p.m. Thursday, November 4th, at Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory. The Mass of Christian Burial for Marina will be 10:30 a.m. Friday, November 5th, at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Rickardsville, with Father Noah Deem as the celebrant. Burial will be in St. Joseph Cemetery in Rickardsville. Marina was born June 29, 1929, in Balltown, Iowa. Condolences may be sent to the family by visiting Marina's obituary at the website hskfhcares.com. Mark Daniel Relihan, aged 57, of Dubuque, died Monday, October 25th, at his home after a 5-year battle with cancer. A celebration of life for Mark will be 4 p.m. until 7 p.m. Friday, November 5th, at the Best Western, 3100 Dodge Street. Mark was born July 31, 1964, in Dubuque, the son of Dan and Joanne Grace Relihan. He was a member of the Hempstead High School class of 1982. In lieu of flowers, a memorial fund has been established for area residential care for an organization dear to Mark. Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory is in care of the arrangements. A photo tribute can be viewed and condolences sent to the family by visiting Mark's obituary at the website hskfhcares.com. William R. Harris, aged 54, of Lancaster, died on Sunday, October 24th. Visitation will be held from 1 to 3 p.m. Saturday, November 6th, at the Platteville Golf and Country Club, where a memorial service will follow. Melby Funeral Home and Crematory of Platteville is assisting the family. And that concludes the obituaries in Tuesday's Telegraph Herald. Turning now to the sports section of Tuesday's Telegraph Herald, Danny Miller, writing on Prep Football, writes, quote, "This game is for you," end quote. Beckman football players rally around teammate battling cancer. As Dyersville Beckman inches ever closer to a trip to the Unidome, a number of factors have contributed to its success on the field. Owen Hewengarth's 1,456 yards rushing and 22 touchdowns are a big reason why. First-year starting quarterback Caden Gassman's captaincy of the offense with a steady hand has played a big part. And that vaunted Trailblazers defense that is allowing fewer than 10 points per game is at the top of the list. But the motivation that has driven this team to play with such cohesiveness and tenacity for 10 straight games now comes from a teammate who hasn't played a single snap this fall. Every Friday night, the Blazers trot onto the field sporting a sticker on their helmets labeled EK6. It serves as a rallying cry to win the game, no doubt, but also as a simple reminder that this season, this incredible, undefeated journey is about so much more. Quote, "Some of the guys go out there and tell me, this game is for you. You going through this makes me want to play harder," said Easton Colker, who was diagnosed in late April with synovial sarcoma, a very rare form of cancer. Quote, "Just having me on the back of their helmets out there, they say, helps them a lot," end quote. April 29th, 7:57 a.m. Quote, "I'll never forget it," said Easton's mom, Carrie Colker. "It was April 29th at 7:57 a.m., end quote. Easton was getting close to wrapping up his junior year. His Dyersville Beckman soccer team was 6-1 and making a push toward another state tournament when they noticed a lump on his upper left thigh. At first, it was believed to be a hip flexor or a sports hernia, but after an ensuing series of tests, they received the news. Quote, "I was diagnosed with synovial sarcoma," Easton Colker said. "They said about 100 people are diagnosed with that specific cancer each year. It was kind of just unexpected. It hit me just kind of fast. I took it better than I thought, but you can't really take that news well," end quote. The Colkers were informed that Easton would need to undergo 7 rounds of intense chemotherapy over the next 6 months. Quote, "It's an emotional gut punch that no parent wants to hear," Kiri Colker said. "Something about you just kind of bubbles up, and you realize you have to be strong for your child and your family. But when it is your child, you wish you could take it away and give it to yourself," end quote. The diagnosis meant the remainder of Easton's soccer season was over, as well as baseball in the summer and likely football in the fall. Coming to the understanding that his final year of high school was going to look drastically different was the most difficult part. Quote, "The reality of it happening was the toughest part," Easton said, "realizing that it's not going to be a normal senior year. I'm not going to be able to go out and socialize as much as I'm used to, and I'm not going to be able to do things with my friends," end quote. quote, "In this family, no one fights alone," end quote. Easton was now entrenched in his battle, but it was clear he was not alone. Roughly a month after his diagnosis, the Dyersville community designed yellow and gold bracelets that read, quote, "In this family, no one fights alone. Easton, number 6, strong," end quote. All of the proceeds from the bracelets were donated towards Easton's treatment. Quote, "It's been an emotional roller coaster, but we've had this support every step of the way," Carrie Coker said. "I can't even put into words what it's meant to all of us. This community, his team, his class, it's been a journey that they've all been on with us. To see all of this compassion and the faith come out in people, we could not have done it without all of that unwavering support," end quote. The bracelets spawned t-shirts and sweatshirts, members of the community brought meals over to Coker's residence, and most meaningful to Easton, his gridiron teammates made a point to contact him after every game he could not attend. Quote, "They FaceTimed me after the games and asked me how I thought they did and how I'm doing in Iowa City," Easton said. "The football team has been my biggest supporters, but my entire support system has been amazing. I constantly have people praying for me. The school prays for me over the announcements when I'm gone. They were a big impact on my journey with this," end quote. Special bond, special night. October 1st already had the makings of an electric night. Beckman was 5-0, headed into its much-anticipated homecoming matchup with Class 1A powerhouse Waterloo Columbus. But the magic of that evening came before kickoff. Roughly 15 minutes before the start of the game, Easton was announced as the school's homecoming king. King and his twin sister Addie named the queen. Quote, "That was an amazing night," Addie Coker said. "When I found out that we had won, I was in shock. It was awesome for Easton and I to be the first twins that won. It was definitely one of my favorite memories, for sure," end quote. The Trailblazers followed with a thrilling 35-34 overtime victory to cap off an unforgettable evening. Quote, "Winning king, having my sister named queen, and then coming out with that overtime victory, it was a pretty special night," Easton Coker said. "Looking up in the crowd, seeing the parents and students get excited after we made a big play, it was awesome how into the game everyone was that night," end quote. According to their mother, Easton and Addie have shared an inseparable bond since the very beginning. Quote, "I think the only time they have been apart was the 38 minutes that they were born apart," Carrie Coker said. "They truly go hand in hand," end quote. That's what's made Easton's visits to Iowa City so difficult. Quote, "He's been my best friend my whole life," Addie Coker said. "I haven't really ever been apart from him," end quote. While Easton is away receiving treatment, Addie has developed a way of coping. Quote, "When he's gone, I'll put on one of his sweatshirts and sleep in his bed, and it just feels like I'm still with him," she said. The wave, Beckman style. As memorable as homecoming was, there was one more night Easton insisted on being at from the very beginning of his journey. Quote, "He told the doctors, I have to be back for senior night," Carrie Coker said. Unfortunately, an unexpected trip to Iowa City prevented him from attending the Blazers' 41-7 win over MFL Marmac to cap off a perfect 8-0 regular season on October 15th. So the team and community came up with a plan. Quote, "I didn't know it was going to happen at all," Easton said. "It just kind of hit me by surprise. It was pretty special and put a big smile on my face," end quote. As Easton watched the game via live stream from his hospital room, the crowd and his teammates turned toward the press box at the end of the first quarter and began to wave. Quote, "Easton, Easton, Easton," the crowd chanted, end quote. Quote, "It was a lump in the throat," Carrie Coker said. "It was a pretty emotional impact that they included him in any way they could for that evening. It's a moment we will never forget." Head football coach Mark Atwater said it was necessary to recognize Easton for what he's meant to the team. Quote, "He brings a positivity that is unmatched," Atwater said. "He's just kind of doing it. For an 18-year-old kid, that's impressive. He's taken it in stride and he's tough. I feel like our team resembles that toughness a little bit. We play in a fashion of what Easton is." Quote, "What he brings us and what kind of special person he is, it's just special. We were in the middle of battle, but we take that to pause and also realize we are here for a different reason," was pretty neat. It really puts things in perspective. Everybody had a little bit of the chills that night. End quote. Looking ahead, on Wednesday, just 48 hours before Beckman kicked off its second-round playoff game against West Branch, Easton completed his seventh and final round of chemotherapy. Quote, "The doctors told us they were going to bring him to death and back, and that's exactly what they did," Carrie Coker said. The next big step comes on November 10th, when a full-body PET scan will be performed to make sure the lump on Easton's thigh is reacting well and his body shows nothing else abnormal. From there, he will have scheduled checkups every 3 months. It's a shining light at the end of a grueling 6-month journey that this 18-year-old tackled head-on and handled with strength, poise, and determination. Easton was on the sidelines Friday as the Blazers took down West Branch and moved within one game of the Unidome. He will certainly be there this week as well, in the quarterfinals, against MFL Marmac, and for however long the Blazers can keep this incredible run going. But he wants the focus to stay about the team. Quote, "I'm proud of my team and how they've played," he said. "I'm not really wanting them to dedicate this to me because this season has been all about them. Watching this and being part of this has been just a great feeling." End quote. His ultimate goal is to be able to compete in soccer and baseball this season, and his doctors have told him they are going to support that goal every step of the way. And while Atwater wasn't able to coach him this season on the football field, the moment Easton steps foot on the soccer pitch or the baseball diamond, he will be watching. Quote, "I know I will be there," he said, "wherever, whenever that may be." End quote. The article is accompanied by a photograph of Easton Coker as he hugs his twin sister Addie after completing his final round of chemotherapy on Wednesday in Iowa City. Turning to Tuesday's Amy Dickinson column, "Dear Amy, we are a tight-knit small family. We usually spend 5 to 7 days at my parents' house together at Christmas time every year. My brother is a heavy drinker with a huge drinking problem. He is condescending, rude, and berates everyone. In 2019, after years of this behavior, I had had enough and flung some very honest truths at him before packing my bags, leaving, and spending my holidays alone. It was also the last time I got to see all of my family before the pandemic hit, so it has been doubly hard. I am still very hurt by my family, who have watched him behave like this over the years and still allow it to take place. My mother told me, quote, "It's just how he is. He treats everyone like that," end quote. He has never apologized for or acknowledged his behavior. I have made it clear to my parents that I will not be present at family functions he is invited to. My boyfriend and I are expecting our first child around Christmas, and I want to spend the holidays with my family, but I don't know what to do. I can't subject myself to his outbursts anymore. I have an at-risk pregnancy. I know it isn't my place to ask my parents to choose between us. I don't want him to spend his holidays alone either. He literally has no one other than us, is prone to depression, and his health is failing because of his drinking. I'm so conflicted, and so are my parents. I love him, but I just can't do it anymore for my own physical and mental health. It is eating me alive thinking about the stress during what should otherwise be a very happy time. What should I do? Signed, Holiday Headaches. Dear Headaches, if your baby is due around Christmas, it might be wisest for you not to bring a newborn into a crowded house for an extended stay. Newborns are extremely portable, but the early days are an ideal time for the parents to hunker down, love on their new child, and adjust to parenthood. You don't want to ask your parents to choose between their children, but you have drawn a hard line regarding your brother. This is for your own well-being, and it is vital that you take care of yourself. Addiction tends to destabilize the family structure. This can lead to what feels like a power struggle, as family members sometimes try and fail to control the addict's behavior. You can expect that the long-standing dynamic in your family will continue. What you can do is keep your distance while working on releasing your anger and replacing it with compassion. Plan for a visit with your folks when your baby is around 3 months old. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Tuesday, November 2nd. I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening.